This podcast is brought to you by Boyle Sports. Download the Boyle Sports betting app now for the best odds on offer for this summer's Euros. Boyle Sports. This is betting. Terms and conditions apply. 18 plus bet responsibly. BeGambleAware.co.uk.
The killing of George Floyd on May the 25th, 2020 in Minneapolis by now former US police officer Derek Chauvin sparked global protests against police brutality and racism. Black lives matter. Black lives matter. Some similarities in the public response have been drawn to that followed the murder of Stephen Lawrence, who was 18, when he was killed by a racist gang in southeast London in 1993.
It began peacefully enough, around 1,000 people marching in the cause of racial harmony. But feeling in this area is running high at present, and underlying tension was soon to surface.
Stephen's family share the pain of losing their loved one in such shocking circumstances, as well as the difficulties of being thrust into the media and public spotlight in their quest for justice.
It'll be a year today, roughly about 10:30 tonight, that Stephen was murdered. A whole year of suffering and feeling as if no one really cares.
Our main concern now is to try and get justice for Stephen Lawrence.
Stephen's younger brother was 16 when he died. Stuart was watching television with his wife and young son when he first saw the murder of George Floyd.
I was horrified. I was horrified to see the images, to see the video. I haven't watched it all. I've never watched it all. The most I've watched is like 3 or 4 minutes of it. I just can't. My big thing about it was, is all the people that stood there watching and did nothing. That's what first got me about it all. And then the reaction afterwards has been phenomenal. It's another point in the world and time where we can move the conversation forward again. And hopefully that not just only talk about things, because this is that I'm mindful as well, that we speak a lot about things. There's lots of conversations going on, but I say to people, how much does that turn into action? How much does that turn into tangible things that you can then go, wow, like that happened, and then this and this was talked about, and then they did this, and that made a massive big difference. And then we'd be able to move forward, because this is what it is for me. We talk about things and we get frustrated, but it doesn't perpetuate into action. Wouldn't it be great to say that we're a country that we have no place or time for anyone that wants to persecute anyone because of things they can't change? So those 9 protected characteristics, we stand by them as fundamental blocks of, it's unacceptable for anyone to say, write, do anything against anyone in those protected characteristics. And wouldn't that be a great advertisement for the rest of the world to say, look, wow, look at Great Britain, look what they've done of how to tackle and to eradicate problems in society.
So how much has really changed? Will younger generations be the difference in tackling discrimination? And will better representation lead to a more inclusive society? Welcome to the Sky News Daily Podcast with me, Dermot Murnaghan, as we examine the story beyond the headline.
Just been watching the football and stuff.
And I'm an Arsenal fan. So,
oh, buddy, we're in the same boat, don't worry.
Great.
A rubbish season, so
that's a relief.
My name's Stuart Lawrence. I am the younger brother of Stephen Lawrence. I am a husband. I'm a dad. I'm an ex-school teacher, now author. I go around and I speak to young people about the impact of choices that you can make and the impact they have on each other. Generally trying to make the world a better place than what I've seen it as I've been here to when I leave it. So that's just who I am.
You know, let's just start, as we should, with memories of Stephen. He was, 2 years older than you? Your big brother, and you describe him as a superhero.
Yeah, just because, as I said, I shared the bedroom with him from the age of 5. And I think before going to sleep every night, you know, sharing and speaking to someone, it has a massive impact on your life. And yeah, I just remember wanting to be like him so much. You know, he had some really cool friends. He had the coolest clothes. He listened to the coolest music. He had his finger on the pulse of life, so to speak. And I just wanted to to emulate him as much as I could. That's why I describe him as my superhero, because I just looked up to him and I just wanted to be like him so much.
When he was taken from you, taken from us, he was on the cusp of adulthood, 18. Had he talked to you about any of those plans for the future?
I think what really the whole main driving force was for Stephen was the architecture side of things. Yeah. And he was so, this was the emergence of hip hop and sort of the music from America. So he was really onto that as well. And I just, like I said, I just remember him just super excited about where it was going next. And he went to go to concerts and stuff as well. There was a program called The Word on Channel 4. Yeah. Which he used to be able to sneak on and get on there sometimes and meet all the guys, all the rappers from America and stuff. So, yeah, he was just living life. And, yeah, as I said, architecture and studying and going to university was something he really wanted to do and become himself. So they're the conversations and things we spoke about at the time.
Stuart recently published a book called Silence is Not an Option. You can impact the world for change. So tell me about the decision to write the book, and, you know, it's 28 years. Is there a reason that it's taken that long, or just tell me?
Yes and no. I suppose after being a school teacher and an understanding the importance of what books can do for young people and how you can use them to change and influence people, I suppose that's what wanted me to write a book. But then also just the stress of life and the rung of life, just didn't ever think I'd have the time. And then sort of lockdown happened and my busy diary got blown out of the water and I was sitting at home twiddling my thumbs. And I say to people all the time, like, as a school teacher for 17 years, 11-year-olds, when they used to come in at the year seven, so like bright-eyed September, you know, big bags, big blazers, big coats and stuff. I used to love it because it was the expressions on their faces and you could just see that it was ticking away in their mind because they were the big I am in their primary schools. And all of a sudden, it's like someone pulls a rug from them and all of a sudden they're looking at these kids going, oh, my God, like, they're so big. And then all of a sudden, there's like seven or eight different teachers you've got to get to know and to know what they want and what they don't like. And it's just remarkable. But I always say to them, like, it's a brilliant time to reinvent yourself. Whatever you now want to be, this is the next part now into adulthood where you can make choices about careers and the direction of your life you want to go in. So, yeah, as I say, it was just how can I help them get through this thing called education and school, secondary school, as painless as possible with as much help and guidance as possible. So that's why we wrote the book.
So you're talking about, what, 10, 11 years old, and writing in an accessible way for that age group. Obviously, that teaching experience, you've just explained it, that was massively helpful.
Super helpful because... And that's also, I think, what some adults get a bit mystified about. It's not a case of you have to talk down to them. You just need to be a bit more descriptive in the language you use and a bit more relatable so they can start to put the blocks in to join things up. And I always say to people as well, there was a book I read as a young child called What Adults Say, But What They Really Mean. And I read this book, age 10 myself, and thinking to myself, I've cracked it now. I know what they're up to. So the things that when they used to say to me, have you tidied up your room yet? They're saying to me, go and tidy your room. That's what they're saying really there. They know I haven't tidied it. So it just gave me this insight to the way that adults would speak to me. And then from that point, I just realized it's about how that meeting of people, and it doesn't matter who they are, young, old, it's how do you broach something and then find a common place and then from there build on it.
Were you and Stephen big readers when you were kids?
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those things, we never had the distraction of the computer games. You know, the TV, when I was growing up, three channels. I remember Channel 4 starting. And then a couple of years after, I remember Channel 5 starting. It was just like, oh my God, we've got five channels now. Like, wow. We're like, we've hit the big time. And it's just a form of entertainment. It's a form of escapism to do something. It's a lot harder now to get them to read. And that's something that, again, my own son who's 10, it's a challenge for me to get him to read more. As I go around to schools, that's one of my key things to tell kids as well, about the importance of reading and what it can do for you and how it can help you go forward in life as well. So,
and as writing the book, Stuart, has it helped with that process? I know it's a process that never ends, of dealing with the anger, the grief. Is this part of that process? I mean, not the main reason, but of course, nevertheless, you know, a byproduct.
definitely. And it wasn't until 2018, really, I realised I was on some sort of hamster wheel from 16. So I went to school the next day after Stephen died. Like, I was really sort of like, yeah, I know, I was on this mission, because education and learning, it just never came easy for me. My mum mentioned it recently, how, you know, she never had to worry about Stephen and him doing his work and obtaining and getting on, where she did have to worry about me. And that's because I didn't find out I was dyslexic until I was 21, 22. So I had to work at it a bit harder. And then I just really developed like a steely attitude of learning is cool. And it's got something that you could do every day. And you've just got to keep pushing forward on that.
Later on, we discussed how far he thinks we've come since his brother's death. I want to compare and contrast, or maybe just compare, then and now. Silence is not an option. We've got that word silence. And of course, you know, that's one of the key words in the Black Lives Matter movement. Silence is violence. I mean, is that a deliberate resonance with right now? And is it telling us, Stuart, that, you know, a lot hasn't really changed since 1993?
A little bit. For me, it was about empowerment. In my acknowledgements, I put a note in there about Greta Thunberg, because for me, it's one person's steely determination, you know, one person's small voice that's developed into a much louder voice, because she consistently said the same thing. Like, there's something wrong. The environment needs to be fixed. We need to do something about it, guys. I can't do nothing by myself. I need the adults involved. And she just kept on saying that. And then she just galvanized support. Sometimes there's other people who aren't able to speak up. Should we not speak for them? We should speak for them like that. That's, again, what it's about, isn't it? If you can see someone that's in help in need, there's something innate about us as human beings to try and want to help.
But as you're saying there, I mean, it takes also constant vigilance, constant actions on it, because the job is never done. You know, thinking back to your brother's murder, we had the McPherson report. That's a long time ago now. And in the McPherson report, I mean, it was, I'm sure you can tell us in many forms about its deficiencies, but it identified, and it was a revelation to many people in the UK, it identified institutional racism within the police forces, which many people thought, oh, no, that can't be the case. And, of course, defined race hate crime. And as I'm saying, you know, we're talking a couple of decades and more ago, yet these are still major, major issues, which, as you've just been telling us, we need to keep working on. We need to keep pushing.
Definitely. There has been some progress made. And this is what I say to people. I don't want to be one of these people who say, oh, no, it's all bad. Nothing's changed. Some things have changed. Some things have progressed forward. But we're at this point now where we're looking and some people are saying it feels like we've gone backwards slightly. So, you know, I'm doing some work with the Met Police myself around cultural understanding and community cohesion. But that's still nearly 20 years on since McPherson. So the motions just need to go a bit quicker. So people can go, oh, wow, we have. And even though, you know, this is part of the stuff that we've been doing recently, looking at the Sewell report. The Sewell report makes the same recommendations as the McPherson does about police training, around community cohesion, around stop and search, and around police attitude schools. These are the same messages. That's my frustration. Well, how can we talk about the same thing? And then we've just heard that the police is no longer institutionally racist. How's that happened? When did we get to the point where they were institutionally racist to the point we're at now where they say, we're no longer, we've managed to crack it. You know, those are the things that make the everyday public person look at it and go, well, I don't think you have. And that mistrust and that misunderstanding, that's where it stems from. I feel so sorry for Cressida Dick about it as well, because she's only trying to do what she can. And I'm sure from like I said, from 99 to now, there has been massive progress made with the police forces and their attitudes and stuff. But we need to make sure that we're identifying and saying where things went wrong so that we know where we were then, so that we can move better forward in the future.
A year ago, George Floyd was killed on camera. His death led to mass protest in the US. But it also inspired a movement here in the UK. Forward! People demanding change. This is Stuart Lawrence.
And you made a TV documentary, haven't you, with some of our TV colleagues? I mean, have you found that this is, as you've gone around the country, I know you've been talking to a lot of very different people, some of whom have been involved in the recent protests, that it is now embedded as part of the national conversation?
Yes, it is embedded. I definitely say that. I feel like sometimes the focus of it does slightly veer off at certain times, and I'm fearful that, you know, especially now that we've got the vaccine and things are starting to get back to some sort of normality, that, you know, people's attention and focus will slip and go back to everything's okay, the world's great, you know, I'm going on holiday, there is no problems, and that sort of blinkered approach, which I think a lot of us had our blinkers removed since lockdown, where we've had to stop and look and listen and pay attention and realise that, you know, things are not all as great and rosy as we think they may be for everyone.
What do you think about some of the symbols that say, and I'm talking about taking the knee here, you know, that say it's not okay? You know, some people saying, well, look, that's just turned into virtue signalling now. It doesn't mean anything. Or is it important? What do you think?
And I think it's a personal choice. One of the young people asked me recently about Wilfred Zaha not taking the knee, what my impression and what my thoughts around that was. And I was saying, do you know what? I like that people are allowed to express their own opinions. And for me, yes, it's a great symbol, but is it really making the changes and really pushing the agenda forward? Because football players are still being racially abused on social media. I love the symbolism behind it all. I love that it creates talking points and it brings attention to things. But whether that will be the one thing that eradicates it or pushes it forward, I'm not too sure that will be it. But again, it's a start. It helps the conversation. It helps the movement forward.
Coming up, I want to bring you someone who's trying to drive change from within.
My name is Ramal Davis. I'm a youth outreach worker from Nottinghamshire Police. My dad was actually born in Jamaica, and when they came over here, some of them came over during the Windrush generation. When my dad got to 16 years old, there wasn't very many opportunities for black people at that age back then. So he ended up joining the army. We were based in Germany, so I was actually born in a military hospital. I came over here when I was around 4 years old.
This podcast is brought to you by Boyle Sports. Place £5 Accas and get a sixth one free with Acca Loyalty on the Boyle Sports betting app. Boyle Sports. This is betting. Terms and conditions apply. Offer applies to mobile bets only. 18 plus. Bet responsibly. BeGambleAware.co.uk.
I think for me, you know, it was really, really nice growing up in a household with mum and dad both at home, who were fantastic role models for me. They went out to work every day, so that really instilled that kind of work ethic in me. I remember one Christmas when everyone had a PlayStation well before I did, and then I got a PlayStation and I actually broke down in tears because everything we got, it was like gold, because they really made us see that you have to work hard for something and you have to behave. And that is really affecting me till today, because it's given me that same structure, that kind of belief that you need to work hard to achieve things in life, and nothing easy comes for free.
Romel's childhood memories were not all positive.
I remember when I first started primary school, some of it wasn't necessarily the obvious things around the skin colour. It was other things that are quite prominent within black people. So people would make fun of the size of my lips, the size of my nose, which are obviously all features that I can't help. I remember one day when I stood at a bus stop and a van drove past, and then they were making loads of monkey noises. Sometimes it isn't always the N-word and some of the obvious racial slurs. Sometimes it's more kind of the microaggressions as well. You know, for example, I could come across a random person maybe, and one of the first things they say to me is that, oh, I like rice and peas, or I've been to Jamaica or something like that. And it's that kind of thing which, you know, makes quite a lot of us feel uncomfortable.
Some of the racism Ramel experienced growing up left him feeling very angry, and he admits he did, on occasion, lash out.
It does get to you, but there are other ways of kind of resolving it without resulting in violence, and especially doing a job like I do now, I can really make a difference.
The 34-year-old told us about one of his first interactions with police officers.
I was a teenager on a council estate. It was late at night. I was on a bike going up a road and I saw someone a bit further behind me. They weren't in uniform, but they were also on a bike. Didn't really think anything of it. And then all of a sudden, they kind of grabbed me and then pulled me off the bike. And they was like, what are you doing? And I was just like, I'm going to my friend's house. I think at this time, this is when phones were absolutely huge because they were, you know, the bricks. And obviously my pockets looked quite bulging. So, you know, then they started saying, what have you got in your pockets? You know, just talk to me with complete disrespect. The fact that they laid hands on me as well for no reason, apart from to kind of stop me from, because I was obviously pedaling on my bike. So they, you know, just literally grabbed my arm and stopped me from moving. And then, yeah, didn't really give me any reason for anything. And then they just went off. Nothing, no apology or anything. And for me, I did shout, you racist. And yeah, I just thought, it's police. And that's what a lot of, unfortunately, black community and other ethnic minority groups feel, that it's just the police. So sometimes we don't actually react very angrily when these things happen because we've kind of grew up generationally used to being treated unfairly by the police. Even when I passed my test and got a car, same thing. If I was in the car with three or four black males, straight away it's a gang, and being pulled over for no reason was common again. Some of those experiences are really negative. And again, until I kind of grew up and got a bit more understanding around things and certainly seeing what goes on within the police now, it's only a really, really small minority of people who do this. And we know that racial profiling, unconscious bias, prejudice, a lot of these things do exist still. But I feel that training is a lot better. So to, you know, have that cultural awareness and things, because even I know there's been examples where, for example, sometimes black people speak quite a lot with their hands. I'm doing it now, but you can't really see my hands on this recording. And that can be seen as aggressive. And sometimes the way we speak, certain cultures, they kind of speak quite loudly. And that, again, it can sometimes be seen as aggression when it's not. That's just how we speak. Things have definitely improved. We've done a lot of work recently around Stephen Lawrence Day and obviously that terrible tragedy as well. And we've definitely moved forward. But, you know, with the anniversary of George Floyd, so there is still a long, long way to go.
Ramel joined the police in his mid-20s after having his first child.
For me, having a child completely changed the way I thought about life. But now there is someone here in this world that's completely dependent on me. And I don't want them going off down the wrong path. I don't want them experiencing racism. I don't want them, you know, unfortunately get involved in youth violence and knife crime, which is a huge problem nationally and you know, certainly in some of the black communities as well. It's, you know, really bad.
Ramel wanted to make a difference, to bring about positive change. He first worked in the control room before becoming a youth outreach worker, engaging with 10 to 18 year olds.
You know, fast forward now, we're over 2 years in and it's a permanent position and we're having massive success in this area as well as across the force.
He thinks the killing of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter protests that followed reignited a conversation which forced society to take a look at itself, including within police forces.
You could understand people like myself who've had those really negative experiences and then you see the shocking death of this man. You could understand why people still feel the way they do about the police. We know there's still a lot to do. There's a lot that needs addressing. We need to make sure we hold people to account with complaints. There needs to be better training, recruitment, and building those relationships with the communities. So 100% I understand that viewpoint around the institutionalised racism. And that is something that, again, we want to completely remove any prejudice. We do a programme called the Mini Police, which is something that we do in primary schools. So right at the grassroots level, we're engaging with young people. So they're already growing up knowing the local police officer and having a relationship with them and having positive interactions. And again, when we're talking about some of the issues around stop search and how we can address that. So working very closely with the community, I think, is showing our commitment to really making a change. This summer, we're doing a programme called Widening Access. So that is actually a targeted programme that we're running where we're bringing in people from ethnically diverse backgrounds into the organisation where they can find out a lot more about what we do, We can tell them about all the fantastic careers. We can educate them on the recruitment process so they have a really good chance of passing the assessments, what it takes to join the police as officer or staff. If we look at the Operation Uplift, which is due to the officers that Boris had pledged a few years ago, and the way that because of that extra funding, because of that extra support, our figures in terms of our representation jumped massively. I don't have the exact figure, but I'm sure it was 7 to 8%, which in terms of the makeup of Nottinghamshire makes us representative now.
Rommel thinks improving representation in the police is a key part to building trust and confidence.
Being of certain ethnicities, being of certain genders really, really does help, because it's about that understanding and having that awareness as well. And sometimes that isn't things you can be taught. It really does help having a real mixture, a real inclusive workforce, because we're able to really look at all the challenges that exist using the experience that we have internally to really make a difference when we go out and do things externally. So it is really, really important to make sure that we have people within the organisation from all walks of life, because we are the community. That's always how I've seen the police.
Stuart and I spoke a bit more about the relationship with his son.
I want to ask you about the next generation. Your son, Theo, he's 10. So, the book must have been written partially with him in mind. And, you know,
yeah, 100%.
What do you say to him about the current situation? What do you say to him about the uncle that he was never able to meet? And what do you say to him about the future?
He knows about Stephen. He knows Stephen's not here no more. We haven't gone any further with the details of why we lost or how we lost Stephen. And the things I say to Theo is, we say to him about two things, which is his attitude and his effort. The two things you can control in life is your attitude and your effort. And as long as you have a good attitude and you apply good effort, then 9 times out of 10, life will be okay. And that's what I say to people. I don't want to have the talk with him about, you know, Theo, you're black, I'm afraid, so therefore, you know, your life's going to be a bit more difficult. I don't want to have that talk, because that's going to give him a complex about life and about himself. So until someone highlights it to him outside of his family unit, outside of that love that he has, until that point, I'm not going to have that talk with him. When it does happen, I'll definitely have the talk with him, and I'll explain to him that, again, in my opinion, his mum's opinion, he's a beautiful little boy, and as long as he's doing good and he's a nice, caring, kind person, then no one shouldn't want to be nice towards him. And if someone doesn't want to, then remove yourself, go somewhere else, because, you know, don't associate yourself with them people. There's loads of people in the world that will like you, that will want to be with you, and will treat you as a decent, the common respect that we have for each other. And anyone else that's not like that, then yeah, let's swerve them and let's not be around them. If young people set the environment and grow into adults and have the positive mindset, accepting of everyone, then I'm hopeful that when my son becomes an adult, that the world will be a different place.
My thanks to Stuart Lawrence, Rommel Davis, and to you, of course, for listening to this episode of the Sky News Daily podcast, hosted by me, Dermot Murnaghan, and produced by Annie Joyce, along with Tatiana Alderson and Nelly Stefanova. The special documentary Stuart has made with us is called Stephen and George, The Killings That Inspired a Movement, and that's available to watch via the Sky News mobile app and on our YouTube channel. If you've enjoyed this podcast, you can follow us in the usual places and leave a review while you're there.
The climate crisis can be an overwhelming and emotional conversation.
We will not let you get away with this.
But it isn't just about cutting carbon emissions or reporting on disasters. On Sky News Climatecast, we'll examine the big issues in depth with scientists, policymakers, and activists. Every week, we'll highlight how small changes can make a big difference as we look for solutions to climate change problems. Sky News Climatecast. Listen, follow, subscribe.
This podcast is brought to you by Boyle Sports. Bet on the number of shots on target, assists, tackles, passes, and more. All powered by Opta on the Boyle Sports betting app. Boyle Sports. This is betting. 18 plus bet responsibly. BeGambleAware.co.uk.